TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Dangers of Climate Change. The Impacts of Climate Change on Oceans and Land. Enormous changes to the oceans, leading to the possible extinction of marine life, are likely because of the main greenhouse gas causing global warming. The huge volumes of carbon dioxide that are produced by industry and transport are already causing climate change. Now, scientists have discovered that about half of this man-made carbon dioxide has been absorbed by the oceans. CO2 reacts with seawater to form carbonic acid, and that lowers the pH level of the water and makes the oceans more acidic. Today, the pH level of the oceans is already 0.1 degree lower than before the Industrial Revolution. The acidification of the oceans is beginning to affect the microscopic plankton at the base of the marine food web and has a knock-on fatal effect from shellfish to major human food species. The findings about acid seas, which are recent, are causing alarm in the international scientific community because they represent a threat until now unknown. They were set out in detail at the Conference on Climate Change at the Hadley Centre in Exeter, UK, in a paper by scientists from Britain's Plymouth Marine Laboratory. Sir David King, the chief scientific advisor to the British government, said, "This is the first time the research has been pulled together. I think it's very serious." End of quote. Dr. Carol Turley, head of science of the Plymouth Marine Laboratory, presented the paper on the impact of the increasing acidification of the world's oceans. She showed a slide of a setting sun over the ocean at the end of her presentation and said the following.
"Preliminary modelling studies show we're moving into unknown territory within the next 50 years. We can see that the pH has remained incredibly constant for thousands of years, if not millions of years, and that these are the variations that are occurring now and up to 210. We also need to think about the synergistic impacts and the feedbacks to the global system of reduced pH, increased temperature, changes in nutrient availability, changes in salinity, oxygen, ocean mixing, circulation and wind. So what are the combined effects on the oceans and what are the feedbacks on the whole Earth system? So I'll leave you here with this, which is a sunset over a warming sea, now over 0.1 pH units lower than pre-industrial, and which contains about 400 billion tonnes of fossil fuel CO2. Its capacity to continue to take up CO2 is limited. Its buffering capacity is limited."
You will hear more from Carol Turley later in this program. But first, here is a talk by Professor Rick Leemans from the Environmental Sciences Department of Wageningen University in Holland. He directs several multidisciplinary projects on global biodiversity. When he spoke at the Hadley Centre in England, he showed photos of birds, fish, insects and plants, from lichen to pine trees, as well as satellite images showing global changes in growing seasons and distribution. What was most shocking was that many of the impacts he was describing have accelerated within the lifetime of our generation, the last 30 or 40 years. Rick Leemans said that widespread ecological impacts of climate change are visible everywhere. Animals and plants are responding rapidly. In the northern hemisphere, they try to move north or up mountains to avoid warming, or they follow the warming trends if they benefit from warm weather. Extinction rates are high among those unable to move and among those who no longer find the other species they depend on in the new environment. Insects, birds, and fish that are capable of relocating have often moved long distances. Plankton species have moved north by up to 1,000 kilometers. Some warm water fish are moving up into the warming seas at a rate of 250 kilometers every 10 years. Rick Leemans comes from Holland, a part of the world where long observation records exist and most people are very familiar with their surroundings. He collected data about the phenology of species, the annually recurring events of flowering, leaf unfolding, fruit ripening, and the migrations and spawning patterns. He found very dramatic changes there as well, and he compares them to the data from around the world. Here is Rick Leemans.
And it's really visible in your backyard. You see changes in timing, in the phenology of species. You see already changes in the geographic distribution all over the world. You can actually go back to documented records, some going back one century, two centuries. And there are these big programs in the Netherlands and the UK, Nature's Calendar, where a lot of voluntary bird watchers, insect watchers, butterfly watchers, and other people actually submit their data. And online, you can actually see what's happening. If you look at the phenology, the starting of the birch flower in the Netherlands, a very strong trend. Same, birch, very important for the pollen season. One of the years, 1990, a very early spring, but a very long pollen season. Pollen has negative impact for people who are allergic to pollen, pollen hay fever, etc. There's actually a very strong synergy with nitrogen pollution and enhanced CO2. Not only is the pollen season longer, starts earlier, there are also many more pollens. So people who have hay fever start to adapt. Insects, butterflies, plants, all actually appear much, much earlier. Very strong trends over many, many countries. Often shifts in months. And some of these phenological trends you already see appearing in some of the satellite data with the NDVI over very large areas. The greening of the world is obvious. Egg laying of the blue tit. Strong changes. Mainly these blue tits do not migrate. So they sit there, they see the oaks starting to leave, they see the small little caterpillars on these trees, and they actually adapt almost instantly to their food sources, which they need for their breed. But the other birds, like the flycatcher, who comes back from Africa and is triggered because of day length, comes 2 weeks too late to actually have a successful breed. The bird appears after the food top is over. So you're actually, with these kind of phenological changes, linking into the very delicate myriads of ecosystem and ecosystem connections. We just published a book on all the observed changes of climate change in the Netherlands. It's called Warm Netherlands. We see a very strong change in the distribution of thermophilic plant, warm-loving species. Many of them have shifted northwards. Even there are 41 new species into the Dutch flora. So in principle, because of climate change, the biodiversity of the Netherlands has increased. But of those 41 species, there are actually quite a lot of rapidly dispersing weed species. And some are very pest species for agriculture. If you find one of those species, for example, has the poetic name of street love grass. But if a farmer has that in his field, has to take very stringent precautions to get rid of it. It shouldn't be, the seeds shouldn't be in the grains, and it's actually quite an expensive pest. So we see those, and they are officially introduced also in the Dutch flora. One of the other species, lichens, which actually have very light spores and travel over the globe with the speed of a 747, if the conditions are right, these lichens actually emerge. And we had a network where, over a period of 30 years, lichenologists actually sampled the lichens and oak species on the trunk of an oak over all of the country, mainly to see the impacts of sulfur and pollution. And in the 90s, most of the lichen species started to come back. But we get an enormous increase in relative abundance of Mediterranean species. And over the last 5 years, we even have some tropical species within the Netherlands. Really, the first signs of these bigger shifts. Same with insects. The wasp spider is really becoming a plague in the Netherlands. The first ones were seen in the middle of the 80s. At the moment, it's one of the most abundant spiders in the Netherlands. There's a shift in different species of fish that actually has already an impact on the other species. And within the marine environment, the shifts go much, much faster than on land. We've seen, if we go gradually a little bit more global, we've seen the coral bleaching. We've seen the mountain pine beetle, especially in northern western US and Canada, which is actually infecting at the moment millions of hectares of pine forest. It's not linked so much to the warming, but actually to the lack of cold temperatures. The pine beetle populations are not killed off by heavy frost occurrences, and at the moment, populations are so big that they actually infested large areas, and this immediately has impacts on the forestry sector and the economics of the whole regions. Similar things over the last decades, the emergence of larger forest fires, mainly linked to drought, and of course a lot of human factors, so it's the build of the fuel, the ignition, etc., etc. But we have seen globally an increase in forest fire. So a lot of impacts of climate change in ecosystems we already see. Now if we look at the global impact assessment models, my conclusion can only be that most of the traditional impacts assessment underestimate the ecological impacts. Why is that? And one of the hints, if you look at the impacts, very many of those impacts are triggered by extreme events. Very warm, early periods in January or February. Drought periods in the summer. So the ecosystem species respond much faster to the extreme events. And the extreme events really are attributable to what we see happening in nature. And most impact models only take the long-term average trends in climate to take the impact. There are very few impact models which actually look at these extreme events. Another additional reason why there's an underestimation of these species. Cynics probably will say extinction is the ultimate adaptation. But that's not what we mean here. We really find an ecosystem precious and we want to keep them. That actually means that we shouldn't only look at an absolute temperature increase, but also at the rates of change. And I propose if we really look at dangerous ecosystems, a rate of not more than half a degree per century should really be the maximum rate. And at the moment, we're far over that. Thank you.
That was Professor Rick Leemans from the Environmental Systems Analysis Group at Wageningen University in Holland. He gave the talk about responses of species to climate change at the Hadley Centre in Exeter, England, at the beginning of 2005. The next speaker is Dr. Carol Turley, head of science at the Plymouth Marine Laboratory in England. She spoke about the other CO2 problem, the impact of the uptake of carbon dioxide by the oceans. Most people are now aware of the impact of CO2 on the atmosphere, but very little has been said and done about the fact that about half of all the man-made CO2 produced so far has actually been absorbed by the oceans. CO2 reacts with seawater to form carbonic acid, and that makes the oceans more acidic. Scientists believe that 400 billion tons of man-made CO2 have already been taken up by the seas, and much more is going in as the world economy relentlessly expands. If the current CO2 releases continue, marine organisms will find themselves in an environment that has not existed for tens of millions of years. Here is Dr. Carol Turley from the Plymouth Marine Laboratory.
Good afternoon. I'm representing a number of speakers from Plymouth Marine Laboratory, just, as you say, just down the road. And this is something slightly different. It's about the effect of the high CO2 in the oceans. There's a few things I want you to take home with you in terms of the ocean role in the global carbon cycle. First of all is that about 50% of global primary production occurs in the ocean, and this is by microorganisms that turn over very, very rapidly indeed, within days. The other key thing is that the fluxes of CO2 in and out of the oceans are very large indeed, and that the oceans are a very massive reservoir for CO2. And Sabine et al. Recently showed that around 50% of the anthropogenic CO2 that's been produced to date has already been taken up by the oceans. So the oceans are, in a sense, mitigating climate change by a substantial amount. But what is the impact on the oceans? Well, the oceans, by a very simple chemical process, results in the formation of carbonate ions and reduction of pH. You can see the concentration of aquatic CO2 increasing and the carbonate ions decreasing and pH decreasing as well. So the oceans are becoming more acidic as they take up more CO2. And here's another paper by Caldera and Wickett just over a year ago, basically simulating changes in ocean pH, assuming continued usage of known fossil fuel reserves. Here are the emissions of CO2, the atmospheric POC2 increasing, and we can see that already ocean pH has decreased by 0.1 of a unit in the surface waters, and that's due to the uptake of anthropogenic CO2. And the projections are that by about 2250, there'll be a 0.77 decrease in pH. And while climate change has uncertainty, we've heard about some of those today, these geochemical changes are highly predictable. It's only the time scale and thus the mixing scale length that are really under debate. And many of the models are very similar. So what? You know, what's a few degrees in pH? What's that mean to the organisms there? Well, Riebezell et al. In Nature published some work where he took pre-industrial or just over pre-industrial CO2 concentrations and incubated coccolithophorids, which are microscopic phytoplankton that take up calcium carbonate and produce these calcite little plates called liths. And he also incubated at concentrations around the 210 CO2 levels. And he got reduced calcification by about 20% in these organisms. So what? A couple of microscopic organisms, big deal. But they are the important, really the largest current producers of calcite on Earth, which is very important in the carbon cycle. They produce these extensive blooms here seen in white, and they transport calcium carbonate into the deeper waters. These liths are shed when the organisms die. They only live for a few days and then they die and basically throw the carbon into the deep seas and sediments. The other key thing about these microscopic organisms that produce these fantastic blooms is that they are important producers of dimethyl sulfide, DMS for short, to the atmosphere. And this is thought to be important in the formation of clouds, and this hence is a negative feedback to climate. And of course, a reduction in the coccolithophorids could change phytoplankton diversity. And this will change, have a knock-on effect on the whole biogeochemistry of the oceans and the ecosystem. Corals, this has had some attention recently. They form hard calcium carbonate, or in fact aragonite, secretions. And at lower pH, they will not be able to do this. The experiments in Biosphere 2 showed reduced coral calcification by about 20 to 40% due to increases in atmospheric CO2. Obviously, this will have a knock-on effect on the whole coral ecosystem and also socioeconomics of areas with corals. We shouldn't forget that there are extensive cold water corals around our shelf seas as well. And it goes on. There are many calcium carbonate fixing organisms in the oceans, and a number of authors here have done a series of experiments on single species showing that shelled animals may suffer from a range of quite serious effects, from reduced growth feeding to susceptibility to infection, decalcification of the shell, and because of that they may be more susceptible to predation, narcosis and even mortality. Here an experiment at pH 7 resulted in 100% mortality of scallops. But more interestingly, this experiment here a Japanese scientist showed measurable impacts on the growth rates and survival of echinoderms and gastropods at CO2 levels of 560 parts per million. That is around the 2050 projected levels. So those experiments were on organisms, but there's been very little work on whole ecosystems. And one area that we're interested in is the ecosystem engineers. These are organisms that essentially structure habitats. Here, these are benthic ones in the sediments. They really structure the habitat they live in. They maintain the benthic biodiversity, and they regulate biogeochemical processes, such as, for example, the regeneration of nutrients that occurs in the sediments that then fluxes out into the overlying water that enables primary production to continue to occur. And we really have no idea of the vulnerability of these key species to reduce pH and high CO2. Phytoplankton, the food of fish. Again, not much research, but there are some experiments showing that zooplankton passing through plumes of high CO2 suffer high mortalities. And zooplankton generally fall into sort of two groups, those with calcium carbonate shells and those with chitinous shells. And so the latter may be less sensitive to pH. But even so, an experiment by Kalahara last year showed that there was reduced fertilization of copepod eggs at CO2 levels beyond 100 parts per million. That is around the worst 2100 worst case scenario. And they are a key part of the marine food web, and the species vary with water mass. And if there is a change in the species, then you may have a change in the fecal pellets, as you'd expect. And the size of the fecal pellets may change. So this has an impact on the flux of carbon into the deep waters, because it is the size and the weight of these fecal pellets that is part of the biological pump that removes carbon into deep waters. There's effect on species of key nutrients here, phosphorus and nitrogen. And these are, you can see that around pH 8 to 7, there are dramatic decreases, changes in the concentration of key species. The consequences for this to phytoplankton and bacteria is not key, but we do know that nutrients are important controls for the evolution of the spring bloom in the surface waters of shelf seas. Phytoplankton use active transport mechanisms to acquire these nutrients, so do they have to use more energy, therefore, to acquire them? So do they become less efficient? And will this impose an ecological deficit? Enzymes, such as those used in photosynthesis, are also pH sensitive. So you have an impact on one part of the ecosystem, and it can have consequences on the rest of the food web, the ocean biogeochemistry, and the whole ecosystem. Who's paying attention? Well, you can see that there are a lot of international organisations, and even the Royal Society's got a working group on ocean acidification. At Plymouth, we're trying to integrate some of the approaches to the science. We're trying to model its effects on marine ecosystems, and we're building a UK experimental facility to look at the impact of CO2, and preliminary modelling studies show we're moving into unknown territory within the next 50 years. We can see that the pH has remained incredibly constant for thousands of years, if not millions of years, and that these are the variations that are occurring now and up to 210. So we don't know if the system will modify and whether we will have cod or jellyfish. We also need to think about the synergistic impacts and the feedbacks to the global system of reduced pH, increased temperature, changes in nutrient availability, changes in salinity, oxygen, ocean mixing, circulation and wind. So what are the combined effects on the oceans and what are the feedbacks on the whole Earth system? So I'll leave you here with this, which is a sunset over a warming sea, now over 0.1 pH units lower than pre-industrial, and which contains about 400 billion tonnes of fossil fuel CO2. Its capacity to continue to take up CO2 is limited. Its buffering capacity is limited. Ocean acidification, I would argue, is another strong argument for control of CO2 emissions that can accompany climate change arguments. Thank you.
That was Dr. Carol Turley from the Plymouth Marine Laboratory. She spoke at the Conference on the Dangers of Climate Change at the Hadley Centre in England at the beginning of 2005. You can find out more about the series on the dangers of climate change on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. This was number 5 of 6 half-hour programs on dangerous climate change, on recent research on the warming of the Antarctic and Greenland, on risks to the ocean currents, such as the Gulf Stream, and to plants and animals. Thanks to the staff of the Hadley Centre in Exeter, England, for making the recordings of that extraordinary conference available. You can get information how to order a copy of the program you just heard on the impacts on oceans and land by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is our only support and helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.